This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast. This is the podcast for March 29th, 2019. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. So Jackie, this week we have an exciting lineup to talk about CERAWeek, your visit down to Houston a few weeks ago, to the biggest event in the energy business.
Yeah, some people call it the Super Bowl of the energy industry, and I think it deserves that title, actually. It really, the who's who of the industry from around the world shows up.
Yeah, how many people go to that thing?
Well, there's 5,500 registrants, but when you consider like the press and the staff, you know, there's a lot of people there. And the most interesting thing is you see people from every part of the oil industry. And, you know, so it's not, although it's in Houston, it's not U.S.-centric.
It's Nigeria, Russia, Middle East, everywhere, right?
Everywhere, yeah. So you really get a sense of what's going on in the
even
global
Canada,
industry.
Right?
Even Canada, although I'd say, you know, we're the fifth largest producer of oil and gas in the world, and we do not have that level of prominence at this event. And hopefully we can change that telling people more about the event.
Well, I had to miss the event, unfortunately, this year again due to some conflicts in my calendar. But it is a must-go event. I've been to it several times in the past, and it's a must-go event if you're in the business of energy, and especially oil and gas, but not exclusively oil and gas anymore.
Yeah, that's right. It's really broad. You know, some people call it, you know, the fossil fuel. I was listening to a renewable podcast and they called it the meeting of the fossil fuel industry. Well, I would say that's not the case. You know, automotive industry is there, battery experts, electrical power is a whole day dedicated to that.
Yeah.
They have this Agora innovation area now that had companies like ABB with an electric race car, next generation combustion engines, you know, area dedicated like a trade show almost to digital technologies.
Yeah.
So it is not just the meeting of, you know, the oil and gas industry.
No, how long have you been going? Well, actually, you used to work for the for CERA.
That's right. I used to work for, first it was called CERA, then it became IHS CERAWeek, and now it's IHS CERAWeek Market.
Okay. CERA is C-E-R-A, Cambridge Energy.
Yeah, Cambridge Energy Research Associates. Right. So when I started going, believe it or not, 12 years ago, I was an employee of CERA. That's what it was called back then. Used to be at the Galleria Mall, used to be a much smaller event. And I actually appreciated it being at the mall because it's like super intense.
That's a big mall in Houston.
Yeah, it's a big mall in Houston because it starts at, believe it or not, 7:30 in the morning and it finishes up at 9 o'clock at night, the formal agenda. And then I strongly recommend people go to the bar because you can just talk to people about all the great things you learned. So it's pretty intense. So when it was in the Galleria Mall, that was kind of nice as a little break to go to the shopping mall. But now it's become too big. And now it's in this very big conference center downtown Houston.
Right. And you can still go to the bar.
Yes, I still recommend going to the bar for sure.
Okay.
Even though you're dead tired, you have to like, you know, have superpowers for that week and make sure you can discuss all the things you learned.
Yeah,
there.
No, I love those intense type of conferences. But let's talk about the themes because, as you said, it's not just a fossil fuel conference anymore. And if you are in the fossil fuel business, the whole theme of being green is really important. And it was a big theme this year.
It really was. The messaging this year from the senior leaders of the oil industry, and I don't care if you're from United States, Europe, or you're Saudi Aramco, was about the fact that we are in an energy transition. Their companies are aware of that. They're changing to understand how they can be part of that future energy mix.
Right. Yeah. So when you think about the word energy transition, the first thing that comes to mind and certainly the headline is that we're transitioning from fossil fuels to renewables, and we are over the long term, but there's another transition that's happening, a big transition within each energy system. And in the fossil fuel, especially the oil and gas business, there is a transition to producing a lower carbon product. And that's a big theme.
Yeah. And it's crazy. If I even think back 2-3 years ago, a lot of these big CEOs, you know, they get up on the stage and they would talk about their projects, their break-even costs for bringing on new oil and gas supply, you know, how they had a good portfolio of projects. But you don't even really hear about that anymore. They're talking about how they're reducing their greenhouse gas emissions, how they're investing in new energy, how they're offsetting the upstream
emissions
that they have.
Yeah, some of these big guys like E&I, they're planting trees.
That's right. You know, so the tree planting is interesting. E&I was not actually at CERAWeek, but they made the announcement during the same week. But that's the first time I'd really heard, it's called nature-based solutions. It's the first time I've really heard this being used in a big way. Shell has talked about it a little bit before. But basically, you know, we talk about carbon capture. We always think of these big industrial plants that are going to, you know, suck CO2 out of power plants and inject it under the ground. But what they're saying is actually planting trees does the same thing. So why wouldn't we just do that?
Right.
And so, yes, E&I announced that they will plant a forest the size of New Brunswick That in, and then on top of other initiatives that they're doing around methane reduction, mm-hmm. they believe they're going to be net zero on their upstream business by 2030. Hmm. And other people talked about the need for the industry to offset emissions through tree planting.
Right. So, I mean, since the narrative is changing, you know, much as we've talked about on our podcast and our writings over the years, the narrative has shifted in the oil and gas business from sort of being resistant to the problem of things like climate change to being part of the solution.
And it really has changed. You know, I was just sitting there thinking about my first CERAWeek back in 2007, and it was just a very controversial CERAWeek, actually, and one that even you can read about today, because Rex Tillerson had just become the CEO of Exxon.
ExxonMobil, yeah.
Yeah, he got to the stage, and he admitted that climate change was a real thing. He basically said, we know our climate is changing. The average temperature on Earth is rising. The greenhouse gas emissions are increasing. We also know that climate remains an extraordinary complex area of study. But he said that we need to reduce our emissions and we need to use market forces to do that.
Yeah,
and that
was just crazy. Yeah, I remember that. It was a dozen years ago. And, you know, that was a big statement because a lot of the multinationals, including ExxonMobil, who was previously led by Lee Raymond, were, you know, maybe not overtly, but certainly in the background, skeptical of the whole climate change issue.
Well, Lee Raymond was publicly skeptical of it. Mm-hmm. And so this was just like quite a big change in messaging, just to admit that there was a real issue here. Mm-hmm. And now go forward to 2019 CERAWeek, there is no debate on the stage that they need to do something and that emissions need to be reduced and that there's a need to transition to lower carbon energy.
Right. So there's a lot of companies as well and attendees who are in the sort of cleaning and greening of the oil and gas system, right? A lot of technology companies.
There was, and there was actually a green tech investing panel, but there was also, that's kind of weaved into so many other things. But the interesting thing, we had talked about green tech investing on our podcast not too long ago, and but we believe that's an area of future growth. But it was interesting when the panel actually had a couple of producers, Equinor, formerly Statoil, they actually changed their name.
The Norwegian guys, yeah.
Yeah, they're transitioning already in their name, and Aramco. And then you had some speakers from the electricity industry, including one from Edison. And there was definitely some friction on that panel on what was green tech, with the oil and gas industry talking about the big changes that are needed to clean oil and gas and all the things that are being done in that way. And the electricity guys saying, you know, electrification is going to be much faster than you think. So you don't need to spend a bunch of money cleaning up oil
right.
and gas.
So in other words, electrification from renewables and these sorts of sources, right?
Yeah, we're not going to use oil and gas for very long. Mm-hmm. So why should we clean it up? So that was kind of an interesting dynamic. Now, of course, the oil guys came back and said, you know, in any scenario, even with lots of EVs, we're going to still need oil and gas for a long time. And therefore, we should try to make it as low emission as possible.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point because as we said on the podcast many times, this transition away from fossil fuels is going to take decades, and the immediacy of climate change is today. And so over the course of the next 20 years or so, there's no question, certainly in my mind, that the oil and gas industry needs to be part of the solution, and it can be part of the solution with these innovations and technologies. And so it sounds like this year's CERAWeek was really almost a turning point in that acknowledgement that the industry is going to be part of the solution. And really, in my mind, the question is whether or not the renewable and sort of the pure green industries are ready for that.
Well, and the interesting thing is carbon capture and storage, you know, that was talked a lot about in maybe in the 2008, 2009 period, but kind of went into dormancy. The thing about it is you could have fossil fuels around for a long time if you found a way to capture those carbon emissions and not have them go out in the atmosphere. And so a lot of discussion that maybe oil and gas could be part of the long-term solution if we considered those types of technologies.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it necessarily has to be. And I mean, I've always been a little bit skeptical about carbon capture and storage, if nothing else, because sort of sweeping carbon under the carpet doesn't do as much as on the consumption side. A much easier solution is just to not use as much and be much more efficient with your usage. But nevertheless, being that it's very difficult to change consumptive behavior, that things like carbon capture storage and also converting carbon into useful products and those sorts of technologies and many other things that are coming is a necessity.
Mm-hmm. And real money going into them, which gets me onto the topic of new energy investing.
Yeah, Bob Dudley, BP's CEO, said some interesting things.
Yeah, so all the majors pretty much at this point are committing part of their CapEx into these new energy investments. So not oil and gas, but something else. BP talked about spending $500 million annually. That would be about 3% of their CapEx this year. And he actually talked about the fact that the industry on average is about 5% if you look at the majors. And, you know, the industry is investing in things like battery technology, charging stations. You know, Shell made a pretty ambitious statement saying they want to become the largest power producer by 2030. That's where they're positioned. They recognize in the power industry, the margins have not been very good over the last 20 years, but they say, you know, they've got to get better. If we're going to do this transition to electrification, the margins have to be there to get the investment. And so they believe that they are going to get a 8 to 12% return over the next 20 years in their electricity investing.
Yeah, and that's pretty good considering that these are stable returns. They're not the type of returns that you get from oil and gas and commodity-based markets broadly, where they're very volatile. I mean, these are much more stable returns over the long term. And I do see many of the other multinationals are branching into these areas, but I don't really expect, I mean, if you look historically at any kind of transition, even outside of energy, the large incumbents are not necessarily the ones that lead the way to the new world, but they eventually become fast followers and transition into the new world. And I think that's what we're seeing over here. And spending $500 million annually or 3% of CapEx for BP is pretty significant.
Well, and I think, you know, it's not just about, this transition is going to take a lot of capital, right? So yeah, some small companies can generate some new ideas, but are they going to be able to scale those to the kind of energy magnitude we need? So you think about a company like BP generating enough money so that they can afford to spend $20 billion a year. Like, it's going to be important that part of that cash flow is used to support the transition. So another topic at CERAWeek was there has been a lot of criticism, like 3 to 5%. You know, this is a much more urgent situation. Sure. So why are you still investing 95% in fossil fuels? And so BP had a pretty good response to that, just saying that the opportunities just don't exist.
Well, I think the opportunities maybe don't exist at that scale for a BP, but I also think that the 95% they're spending in the traditional oil and gas business is completely different in character than it was even half a dozen years ago. I mean, we see it certainly in North America that the costs have fallen dramatically. We had Alex Pourbaix on last week. We talked about the dramatic improvements in cost and emissions. So the 95% that's going into oil and gas is a new 95%. It's not like the 95% or more, say, even from half a dozen years ago.
Well, and then there was this discussion, we need consumer pull, right, for these new technologies and new power sources, and we need margins. That's what the Shell speaker was saying, because we got to make money in this area as well. And so we need the support of consumers and
policies. It's not just incumbent upon suppliers to make change. I mean, consumers have to make different choices, whether it's, as I say, using things more efficiently, using less, or switching and actually making the switch from, say, combustion vehicles to electric vehicles is one example.
Well, a great example, Shell has put a lot of money into charging stations. Well, if no one buys electric cars, it's not going to be a very successful business, right?
No.
So they can only put in a certain amount of capital to get things going, but they need consumers to also invest.
Right. So presumably they're going to put the charging stations beside their traditional gas stations.
Yeah. In fact, I put a tweet out about this. Petro-Canada has announced that they're going to do charging stations across Canada now. But the reality is, there's not a lot of people going to be stopping at those charging stations because there aren't that many cars
in Canada. Well, I'll fill you in a secret. I mean, I've had an electric car, as we've said on this show, for 2.5 years. I have never used a public charging station.
Well, you don't want to hang out at the Petro-Canada for like an hour?
Well, I mean,
they
it's
have
just
Tim Hortons now.
I mean, the thing is that you come home and you plug your car into your garage, and it's just like plugging your phone in at night. Like, it's just, I don't need it.
Yeah, if all you're doing is commuting to work and home, working home.
I don't need it.
You know, it's more for people that want to go on a road trip.
Yeah.
You need to go on a road trip this summer.
I do.
And that will be a future podcast.
Exactly.
Peter's electric car road trip. See if you and your wife can survive.
Well,
those long
it's becoming easier and easier. And things like this. But anyway, so let's talk about Canada. I mean, at the outset, you said that even though this is a global event, and although Canada is the fifth largest producer of oil and gas in the world, the representation was a bit weak. But the representation that was there from companies and government did make a bit of an impact in some of the panels and things.
Yeah, Mark Little, the soon-to-be CEO of Suncor, did a great job. He was actually on a couple of panels and talking about how Suncor has reduced GHG emissions, talking about COSIA, talking about the
What's COSIA? Is that the consortium?
Yeah, they've pooled together their IP and sharing technologies, so collectively reduce emissions more quickly than any one company can do it on its own. That's a pretty unique model.
Yeah.
It's actually, I believe, influenced what's going on now more globally because there's a global alliance like that now.
How has it been received? You mean globally, they're sort of recognizing this collective R&D alliance rather than any one company trying to do it on its own?
Yes, that's right. There's this oil and gas climate initiative and many major producers around the world, the Shells, BPs, but even like Aramco and other national oil companies are part of
it too. That's the Saudis.
The Saudis as well. Mm-hmm. And so basically they are collaborating, sharing technology. They're investing in low carbon technologies, recognizing that this isn't a competitive advantage to have these technologies. It's better if we develop these together. We'll be faster in terms of developing them and then deploying them. And so I believe COSIO was really the catalyst for thinking about how we could do this on a bigger scale.
On collectively and innovating as an industry collectively to meet the challenge of climate change, which necessarily has come with greater policy and policy burdens.
Okay, so the other thing I want to say is it's so important that Mark Little came and talked about the GHG emissions. Because as we talked about on the podcast last week with Alex, there's a perception that Canada is high carbon. He talked about, you know, Fort Hills being actually relatively similar to the average of crude oil consumed in the United States. And the messaging is so important. We need more of it. To give you a little sidebar, I went to this other panel and Saudi Aramco was there and they were talking about how a recent Stanford paper had looked at basins around the world creating the biggest repository ever in terms of greenhouse gas emissions associated with oil. So they had almost 9,000 fields in 90 countries and Saudi Aramco was very proud to say they were amongst some of the lowest carbon barrels in the entire world. And then went on to say that, you know, unlike not to be named, the country to the north of the United States, where their emissions are like, wow, you know, five times more. And so therefore, our barrels should be produced. And so I thought the problem is there is this historical information out there.
10 years ago.
Yeah, that doesn't reflect the new barrels that would be coming on. So it's very important that the models that are used better reflect Canadian emissions.
Just to be clear, Stanford University has a database and researchers that populate that database with emissions from different oil fields around the world, including the oil sands. And the Saudis were trumpeting how good they were in this database in terms of some of the lowest emissions, which sort of makes sense because they've got some of the lightest oil, some of the cheapest oil that comes out of the ground.
Mm-hmm. And they've actually, he talked about, have done a lot to reduce methane and to move to lower carbon power sources. So they're doing a lot of things.
Right. But they were perpetuating this ongoing narrative about how dirty and how bad Canada is based on 10-year-old data. But the Stanford guys, in conjunction with our industry, are now starting to recognize what Alex Pourbaix, CEO of Synovus, was saying last week, that improvements are being made.
That's right. And good news
significant
is
improvements.
These models are so important because everybody uses them.
Yeah.
We really need to improve the Stanford model, which has become really the de facto standard in terms of looking globally at all the emissions associated with upstream oil and gas. And so we need to get that better to represent what the oil sands is today, not what it was a decade
ago. So, I mean, it's a two-part thing. The database has to be updated with independently validated emissions data that is current. And importantly, part two, it has to be communicated better, which is what Alex Pourbaix again talked about last week. I mean, the communication is just so important to get the word out, and it's not getting out. So we are still sort of somewhat demonized based on 10-year-old data.
Yeah, that was still the case at CERAWeek this week. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit more about one other Canadian participation that was worth talking about, which is our natural resources minister. And actually, for many years, the Canadian natural resources minister has come to CERAWeek. So this year, it was Minister Sohi who addressed the conference. And in an interview after his panel presentation, he gave some important information about the TMX project, which
we're all waiting for, the Trans Mountain expansion,
mm-hmm. basically saying that on March 13th, the Indigenous consultation efforts are expected to wrap up within 90 days with the potential to approve the project by cabinet in the summer. So we had done a podcast about 2-3 weeks ago now around what's going on with these different pipeline projects. The big unknown was this Indigenous consultation and the timing. So, hey, we had some news there that was pretty material in terms of maybe summer.
So we could hear some good news before summertime and well in advance of some expected federal government election this fall. I mean, other big themes, we've talked about the green theme and all that, but the application of digital data science technologies is such a huge thing now.
It really is a huge thing, and it became larger in the conference. In fact, they expanded the conference area into another building and they call it the Agora area. And it was basically a digital technology showcase as well as innovation around other technologies. Mm-hmm. But there was like a trade show style little booth where you could learn about technology. There were panels and, you know, all the names. Internet of Things, robotics, cloud computing. If you wanted to learn about that stuff, it was there big time. The interesting thing compared to last year is blockchain was not as crazy. Last year, if you wanted to go to the session on blockchain, you'd have to line up like an hour early because that's how many people wanted to learn about blockchain.
So what is it this year? Let me guess. Artificial intelligence? Is that the big deal?
I think it was just interesting in the topic. There wasn't like one technology where you saw panels being full. But people, those sessions were full. The other interesting thing is it wasn't just about technology. There was a very interesting session that I went to on the challenges with deploying digital technology. It's not just as easy as buying the software. People are resistant to change. And, you know, if someone comes in and tells you, we're going to do everything you used to do differently, it sort of implies that for the last 10 years, you haven't been doing things right. And so, you know, this panel talked about there's a cultural issue here. You've got to find those early adopters in your organization and try to make some wins
there. Yeah, and I think there's a trust issue here that's emerging. I mean, what the utopian view of digital and technologies, including artificial machine learning, is okay, here's my black box. It can think better than your human brain. And okay, there's a lot of things it can do better, but obviously we've learned with this whole Boeing 737 fiasco that there's some things that humans can do better than a black box. And though certainly I've started my career in computing and high volume data science and so on. And, you know, it's the whole adage of garbage in, garbage out. So if you don't prepare your data and put it into the black box properly, you're not going to get very good results on the outside. So I think there's, you know, legitimate concerns about how far this can go. But there's no question that if it's done right, that you can have another significant step change in productivity and cost. So what is anybody saying anything about the amount of improvement yet to come?
I think the number that's out there is there's the potential for a 30% change in cost, whether it be on the operating or the capital cost. So there's lots of opportunity, but I think we need to acknowledge that it's going to take some cultural change. You're going to have to find those people in your organizations that are willing to start making those changes. And so, you know, maybe we're evolving in terms of our conversation, in terms of thinking about how to actually implement this stuff.
It's coming. I mean, when the Googles and the Microsofts of the world get involved in these sorts of things.
Amazon was there in a big way. Microsoft, they had large demonstration areas for their technology. So, you know, think about CERAWeek 4 years ago. This didn't exist at all.
No, it's an industry that is just ripe for innovation. Right? And that's what's happening. What else were they talking about? Sort of U.S. energy independence and dominance with all this growth in the Permian?
Yeah, that was a huge topic. And you had some major big people from the U.S. government, the Secretary of State.
Pompeo.
Yeah. You had the head of the EPA show up. And, you know, I think what really kicked off the conference is the IEA releasing this annual thing that they put out that does a five-year outlook for the oil markets. Mm-hmm. And they're predicting another 4 million barrels a day of growth from the U.S.
That's
like,
ridiculous.
This is phenomenal.
Right.
I mean,
4 million barrels a day of oil, just to put that into perspective, that is the current output of Western Canada. And it's taken us over 100 years to achieve that. And there is, what did you say, in the next 4 years?
So they've grown about 4 million.
So they're going to grow another Canada, which is the fifth largest producer in the world, in the next 4 years.
And the crazy part about that's shocking news, but there wasn't much discussion on it, really. It's, I think, because they've grown so much already, it's much more accepted than it might have been 3 years ago if you had said that, right?
Yeah.
But 4 million barrels a day, that's huge.
Some people are actually throwing cold water on that number, though.
Yeah, that's true. So Mark Papa, I'll bring him up because he was a speaker there. And when he spoke, the room was full. He's actually a relatively small producer from the Permian, Centennial Resource Development. But before, he headed up EOG. And EOG is obviously a company that did very well with shale gas and then got into oil and was, you know, they say sometimes he's the father of hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling. And he put some cold water on the outlook. He's concerned that new oil wells will be less productive due to what he calls parent-child issues. So what he's saying is the first well into an area is very productive, but as you add more and they're close together,
more children,
they become less productive. He said something like the child is 85% as powerful as the first well.
So his thesis would be that, okay, it's all the growth that we've seen so far. The party's going to come to an end at some point. Isn't that what he's saying?
Yeah, there's not as much top-tier resource as you think. And on top of that, the well density isn't going to be as tight as you think. Now, it's interesting. There was a panel that he was on that debated this. And, you know, they had some good arguments for, yes, that might be true, but there's other upside here. They talked about the fact that the Permian specifically, we see a lot of majors coming in and bringing real cash.
The Exxons and the Chevrons.
Yeah, and bringing real R&D to this situation. So the interesting thing they talked about is that up until now, the shale oil has mainly been understood through trial and error, brute force kind of stuff. Like we just keep putting more sand in and, whoa, more comes out. But there really isn't the understanding of the chemistry and the drive, whether it be thermal gradient or pressure gradient or exactly how all of this is happening. And now with the big guys coming in with their R&D departments, as well as more data being available to the universities, there's a belief that as we understand the drive mechanism better, we could actually go
further. The drive
further.
Of the hydrocarbons in terms of how it comes.
Yeah, like what's causing all this
oil
to come.
The flow, yeah.
Yeah. And then also digital AI could help understand this data better in terms of what's, you know, what are the best techniques that have worked in other places and applying them. One thing that was just kind of shocking is the recovery today is, you know, maybe 8 to 10%.
So 8 to 10%. So if there's 1 million barrels of oil in a reservoir, you're only recovering 100,000.
Yeah. So up until now, we've in the case of the Permian, we've grown from 1 million barrels in about 2012 or 13. Then we discovered how to use this technology. Now we're at 4 million. Most people think they're going to get closer to 5 this year.
Right.
And that's just getting 8% of the oil associated with the drainage area of each of those wells. Hmm. And so there was a lot of discussion, like if we could understand the drive here and the science behind it, maybe we could increase that recovery. And then there's also enhanced recovery that hasn't even started yet, whether it be CO2 flooding or water flooding to get more.
I mean, all this, you know, I'll tell you my view. I mean, all this stuff is very technical and there's no question technology is going to be needed, innovation, et cetera. But I'll tell you what, I mean, the whole thing is turning into one big manufacturing exercise, which is relatively new to this industry. And that drilling more and more wells, you learn from each one of the past and you do the next one better and better and better. And the unique thing about what's going on in Texas is just the number of wells that they sink into the ground. And with each one, they learn more. And you're saying that, you know, 8 to 10% is all they recover. You'll learn how to get more and more. You'll go to the places where you left 90% on the ground and get that out of the ground. And so I have to tell you, like, I am a believer in the fact that the 4 million barrels a day more is possible. I don't buy into this, at some point the party's going to come to an end. Well, at some point it will, but it's not going to be in the next 5 or 10 years, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah, there's a lot of resource there. So Mark Popo laid out many of these arguments.
He's a contrarian, right?
No, actually, he laid out many of these arguments. But then the end, he said, but a lot of that's going to be offset by the lower quality and the fact that the parent child. But I have to say, you know, like you say, there's so much innovation out there that, you know, it could be that we see another 4 million barrels a day. At least that's what the IEA thinks about. The interesting thing, the group talked about shale gas. There was like no debate there. There's a lot of shale gas.
Well, that's the thing is, I mean, you know, we saw that we had a lesson in abundance with the whole shale gas thing, which preceded the tight oil revolution, things like the Permian and up here in Canada, the Montney, Duvernay, et cetera, et cetera. But the lessons of shale gas were there's more than you think and that technology can get more out of the ground than you think. But this, let's talk a little bit about the geopolitics of this because the United States emerging with such force in terms of growing its oil production and being able to ship it off the Texas Gulf Coast to all parts of the world continues to be a geopolitical, potentially a destabilizer with OPEC and some. How are they going to keep it together? Did they talk about that?
Oh, there were many sessions. There was actually one where it was explicitly about that, but that kind of creeped into a lot of other conversations. And so I think most people believe this really can't hold forever in the face of U.S. continuing to increase their market share. Mm-hmm. The question, though, is when, and especially, you know, if Venezuela and maybe other OPEC producers continue to decline in their production, then as long as Saudi and Russia can continue to grow a bit, then maybe they can live with this. But there's lots of wild cards. Like what happens if Iran comes back?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if Iran comes back and now Russia and Saudi have to cut more, is that going to be destabilizing? And so I think there's a consensus that it can't last forever in the face of so much growth from the U.S. But the timing is not this year, not next year. We've talked about that too, but maybe longer term.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's clear to me that the whole geopolitical situation with respect to global oil supply, which was dominated by the Middle East and within the Middle East dominated by Saudi Arabia, is changing. I mean, we're going to see, I think, probably more countries like Venezuela succumb to being kicked off the supply curve. And the rise of the United States, I don't think Russia's going away anytime soon, and the Saudis are innovating, and they've got an almost a limitless amount of oil in their fields. So it's a very changing geopolitical situation that we can look forward to, I think, in the next 5 to 10 years.
I want to tell you one kind of funny note is the advisor to the Saudi oil ministry was talking on this topic of, you know, these cuts are sustainable. That was his argument. But he felt that more people should be part of this group, and he commended Canada as cutting their production and felt that more people should be like the Canadians and participate and get a broader group. So, you know, that was his solution, that actually this should become a broader cut. So we all cut so the Americans can grow.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. We could talk a lot more about that. I mean, we did cut with our curtailment here. And in some ways, it is a technology story on one hand and a lack of pipeline story on the other hand. But on the technology side, it sort of demonstrates that, like the United States, we are able to get more and more out of the ground at lower and lower cost. And we've been sort of a victim of our own success. And the Saudis have encountered that as well, and that they had to cut. So it's going to be a very interesting world of oil over the course of the next 5 to 10 years with all the innovation also around producing a better product, a lower carbon intensity product, which you said was the main theme at the front end. So we're looking forward to next year's CERAWeek to see what they say.
We certainly are. And for all of our listeners, I encourage people to go. It's a great way to get outside of just thinking about Canada and seeing the global world. I recognize it's quite an expensive conference to go, but the good news is they actually put videos up of a lot of the sessions. And so in the show notes, we'll put a link to the video page. And many of the talks I actually referenced are up there,
fantastic,
including some of those technology sessions. So people should use that resource. It's free.
Yeah, I know our listeners would really enjoy that. So they can expect that when we post this podcast.
Great. All right. Well, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed it, please rate us on the podcast app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.